Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello, my fan friends. Welcome to another Rahela Stepper this week with the charming and hilarious Catherine Bohart. If you haven't seen her yet, she is definitely a name to watch. Really fantastic comedian and brilliant person. I'm in the BDSM driving school offices right now. I hope Peter Dibden doesn't catch me. We are hopefully doing more Twitch of fun very soon, including some sketches, as well as the usual puppetry. Usually on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. on twitch.tv/rkherring, where you can also catch live recorded Rahela Stepers and me playing snook against myself, though not this week because I'm off for a week filming in actual real film. My career's really taken off. I'm an overnight success. It's only taken 31 years to get to this point. Don't think I'm playing a pervert, but he's an overweight businessman whose business is going down the toilet. Look at my bearded face. So do check out my Twitch channel. Do become a badger if you would like. Do subscribe if you're with Amazon Prime on twitch.tv. It doesn't even cost you anything and we still get money if you're with Amazon Prime. Otherwise, why not just sit back, relax and enjoy Rahela Stepper with Catherine Bohart. Here it is. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Please welcome a man who's just been serenaded by a bottomless muffin man. It's Richard Herring. Hello. Welcome to Richard Herring's Lottery Sperm Top Dog podcast. I've got some sperm behind me going to an egg. It's suddenly feels like a misjudgment for the podcast. I just thought, thinking about how we're all the sperm that won that lottery and existed. When you think about it, 600 million to one, we're all here, and that's just for that one little go. So I've decided to make the whole podcast just about that. We'll see how that goes. But I was talking to all the sperm in the ejaculation that created me who didn't make the egg. They're pretty cool about it. They call it Rahela Stepper. So I don't know if that's going to catch on. The reason I decided to put that picture up was because over Christmas, we're recording this just before New Year, 30th of December. We just had Christmas with just the family. It's been quite nice. I don't want to say that in case my in-laws are watching. But just for once, it was nice just to have the four of us. But my son's becoming a little bit more theatrical. He's 3 years old. A couple of days ago, my daughter knocked something down that he was playing with, and he turned to her and said, "You've ruined my life," which I thought was an overreaction. But that's he is quite theatrical. And then yesterday, he was upset about something, and I can't even remember what it was. It wasn't a big deal. He ran to my wife, hugged her, pointed at her stomach, and said, "Put me back in the egg." Because he knows that's where he knows he came from, an egg inside his mum, and she said, "What, in my tummy?" He said, "Yeah, put me back in my egg." So that's a 3 year old's. I didn't ask to be born. I thought that was a beautiful way of putting it. So we decided it would be a mistake to try and put him back in the egg for all concerned, and we have kept him out of the egg for now. But just downstairs, just now, he was standing on an armchair singing, "Have you seen the Muffin Man?" or "Do you know the Muffin Man?" And we were laughing at him because he was quite funny. And then he really enjoyed the laughing. And then he took down his pajama bottoms and started dancing with no bottoms on. And we laughed more. And then we said, "Put some bottoms on." He said, "I'm the Muffin Man. I don't wear trousers." I think he might be a comedian. We will find out. I think both of them might be. Let's see what else I've got for you. We'll quickly talk about... I've got that piece of paper there. If you are watching on Christmas Day, I've won my third TV show apparently in a month, even though Tipping Point was actually recorded in July 2019. The Chase was recorded in September, and Taskmaster was even finished in July. But they've all come out in 3 weeks, and we had a very thrilling time on The Chase with Kay Burley, hugging her. She's broken the COVID rules once. Let's break them again. This was actually again before that. So very good fun. I hope you enjoyed it. Poor old Tim Lovejoy there got knocked out. What a shame. We won £150,000. That's not bad, is it? I'm in danger of damaging the brand is what I'm saying. I meant to come second and I've just won three things. There's also a point of celebrities in the can ready to go out at some point. How did I do in that? If I win that, that's the end, isn't it? That's the end of me. But my main thing at Christmas that blew my mind was on Boxing Day, there was a cartoon in one of the papers about the Three Kings being criticised for moving around during lockdown. It was what you imagine, not very good. But it used the phrase "traverse afar," which I had never heard, and I couldn't understand why it was saying "traverse afar" in it. Had the cartoonist gone mad? You know, we all know the lyrics of "We Three Kings." "We Three Kings of Orient are, bearing gifts we travel so far," right? I know that better than anyone because I was the frankincense king at primary school when I was 8. And even if I had learned the song without reading it, and I could read by the time I was 8, so I probably did read it, then I've sung the song so many times over the last half a century that I've read it, what I've been singing it, and I've never seen the phrase "traverse afar." I would have had the words in front of me and surely noticed this weird fucking phrase that doesn't even make sense. You traverse something. You can't traverse afar. You traverse a thing. It doesn't even make sense. But if you look it up, those are the lyrics. I've got through 54 Christmases without even realising the lyrics of the hymn are all over the place. And John Henry Hopkins Jr., who wrote it, is a fucking idiot. It's a terrible hymn. It's clunky from the start. "We Three Kings of Orient are." It's odd for a first line of a song to have tortuous grammar in order to get a rhyme. You can make the first line anything you want. Feels like he really wanted to call them kings from the Orient for some reason, and then realised there's no rhyme for Orient, but he wasn't going to let that get in the way. He could have said, "We three kings have followed a star, bearing gifts we travelled quite far." That's what I'd have done. Of course, as kids, you all thought they came from Orient art. We all thought that. We don't even need to say it. We don't need to talk about the alternate lyrics. We know about that. Richard Osman then tweeted, because I tweeted about this, and then he told me it's "God rest ye merry, comma, gentlemen." It's not "merry gentlemen," it's "God rest ye merry," not "the gentleman." And it's also "jingle, comma, bells," not "jingle bells." It's a command to the bells. It's not a type of bell. I've got to 54 and I didn't know any of the 53. It's my 54th Christmas. And I didn't know any of this shit. And it's absolutely traverse afar. Did you know that? I did not know that. I'm very, very upset. Right. We are going to crack on with the show. That's my Christmas stand up. Going out in mid-January for most people. Right, my guest this week is probably best known for being the guest contributor on the paper review on Talk Radio. That's why we're all here. That's probably where you've seen her before. Will you please welcome Catherine Bohart, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello. Hello. I was also the frankincense king.
Were you?
Yes.
Should we sing it together?
We didn't have to sing it because I had a teacher who was like, clearly wanted to be a comedian, and she wrote her own version of the nativity every year that was, by the way, exclusively innuendo. But she cast three ginger children, which you could do in an all-girls school in Ireland, to be the kings so that we'd all look like triplets, I guess. And I just wanted to tell you that. Hello.
That's good. Well, I'm glad we share something. We did sing it too. So I sang the whole bloody thing, and it wasn't Traversa Far. Anyway, but embarrassingly, we've come in wearing the same clothes.
We have, and you've have played the same role. God, I didn't know we had so much in common.
It's crazy.
It is.
Good. Do you remember the Talk Radio paper review that you're best known for? Do you remember what you reviewed in that? It's on your website, so you must be very proud of it.
Is it?
It's in your list of credits on your website. I couldn't find anything on that MVP.
I'd love that to think that I wrote that, but I just copied and pasted it from my agent.
I think it was your first thing you probably ever did, and it was on there to begin with, yeah. And then you've subsequently done some stuff that's
But you have to bulk it out, don't you? You have to at the you start do, you're like, I am a person who performs. no, I haven't got a clue what I was reviewing on iTalk Radio. I don't even remember being there. Never mind. Gosh, that's weird.
You end up doing so many of those things, and then the things you remember are things that nothing, you know, but like sometimes you meet like incredible people on those radio shows. The one that was most exciting, John Sim was on just after me on one of those things. I don't think it was Talk Radio, it was the BBC somewhere. And it was just when he was the master in Doctor Who, and I literally couldn't speak. I was so in awe of him. I think he's amazing, but and he kind of knew who I was, because he knows Kevin Eldon, I think. So he sort of knew who I was, but I was just like a gibbering wreck. And Ken Loach, I did one with Ken Loach. It's crazy who you end up meeting.
Okay, mine is not like, ugh, I just can't remember which giant celebrity was on after me. That didn't happen to me. I probably was at the very start of my career, went in and did it, didn't get paid, and so stole some loo roll from the bathroom. Like, that was probably much more my story.
Well, that's I've deliberately picked on it.
Thank you.
You've done some others. You've done stuff almost as good as that since then. So don't worry. It's been good. How has we're recording this right at the end of 2020. So let's. How's 2020 been for you, Catherine?
I mean, it's a bin fire, right? Like, it's a bin fire. I even, as I tried to answer that, I got most of my own hair in my mouth, and I was like, that's the year. That's it. It's been terrible. But and consistently so. So it kind of gets you used to it. I will say, like, I was talking about this to my friend the other day, and I feel like 2020 was an awful lot worse for the people who came into it thinking life had meaning. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think those people are more crushed. So no, it's been terrible, but I feel like it has ultimately just exposed what life actually is. And because none of us have our distractions, and now we're all just staring at what it is. And it's like, do you mean the meaning? Wasn't the haircuts and the lunches out? And you're like, well, no shit, Sherlock. Yeah. No, it's been bad. Am I supposed to make the? I should make it light.
No, you can say it's. You're allowed to say it's bad. Mine's been all right.
I'm bad.
I'm married and with kids and live in the countryside. It's sort of the same.
Yeah.
And I don't have to go. I sort of don't want to go out. So I'm kind of glad to not have to go out. And you know, I've become a ventriloquist. I mean, that's.
You had me onto the last bit. I was like, oh, that is. Oh, you're having a breakdown.
Yeah, okay. I feel I'm having
That's
a breakdown.
That's all right. Denial is an important step. You got to get through it. That's fine. You know, mine was, I mean, obviously our industry disappeared. And so too then did our incomes. And then also you can't really meaningfully connect with people. And then my 5-year relationship ended. Not my decision, but props to her because it is a good one. And what else happened this year? Like, I can't see my mom because she's high risk, it's bad, but a lot of good telly.
Cool. Okay. Well, I've broken you down. I'm going to build you up over the. But I think, you know, that was it. Sort of make or break. That's what I sort of feel. I like, because we moved about 3 years ago, and you know, that was very stressful. We had a new baby 3 years ago, and we had to all this stuff at once. It's been quite stressful living in this house. And then you kind of think, going through something like this year, that's going to be a real test of a relationship.
Oh yeah. If you make it through 2020, I applaud you.
I think we're stronger than when we went in. I mean, pretty much. So that's good. So it is that make or break thing. And I know a lot of people have, but you know, because of circumstance or whatever, people have broken up.
Yeah.
Do you think it was 2020 or was it on the cards? I mean, because I know you did a podcast together about relationships.
Yeah, and the audacity of it. It was called You'll Do. Lol. I would say that I would say it was 2020, but then that's what I would say because otherwise I'd have to blame myself because I was dumped. Yeah. So let's say it was just a crazy year. It's not like it was me. And I also think, you know, it's fun to watch because I think either people are breaking up or like real long tested relationships are solidifying. But there's also another category of people who should not be, but nonetheless are enthusiastically getting engaged. And those people will be breaking up next year and that'll be fun too. So
yeah, that's true. Well, you know, relationships are kind of, I've been in a relationship now for like, is it 13 years now it's coming up to? That's insane. I think it is. And that's just, like nothing like that had ever happened to me before. I'd never got anywhere near. Like I think I'd managed 2 years a couple of times.
Really?
Yeah. So, and I was 40 when I met my wife. So it was. This is like a, you know, this is a very different. My life is a completely different.
Wow. Yeah. Because
It's possible. Things change.
Yeah. Because this was my longest relationship. Before this, I hadn't gone past a year and a half. But I'm only 32. God, that is. That's mad that you only dated people for 2 years until you were 40.
Yeah.
Do you think that this sounds not to take away from the romance of what is presumably your one true love? But do you think that there was a correlation between you getting to an age where you were ready for it? And
I think so. I did write a book about the year I turned 40 and I went nuts the year I turned 40. So, and then sort of met my wife and then turned everything around really. So yeah, it was, I think I was definitely, you know, I've had a few midlife crises and I don't think it's necessarily over in terms of it's still, the older you get, the more difficult it is to cope with different things. But I think the one at 40 was pretty big. And at 50, I did a show about 2050 and it wasn't really as big a deal. It's just, I think when you're at 50, you're just sort of accepting, oh, actually I'm in this old group now. When you're 40, you can sort of pretend you're still in the young group and it's still a bit embarrassing, but you get away with it. But you can't, if you're 50 and doing that, you're sort of, you know, it's just a bit too icky. So yeah, I've kind of had a pretty wild year up to when I met my wife, or half a year up to when I met my wife, or maybe that whole year. I met her at kind of Christmas, sort of just before Christmas. And so that whole year had been nuts. So I think it was, you know, I think I was ready. Yeah. I think I was ready, and it was about meeting the right person at the right time.
That gives me hope. But, I feel like, I think we are sold a version of how things should go and when they should happen. And so it's nice to hear people have that at different points.
Yeah. And it's been, you know, it's good. And like, well, we were talking, you know, we were mentioning it in the intro, but, you know, having kids when you're a bit older is there's lots of good things about it. It's harder because you're tired anyway.
Yeah.
But so then you're double tired. But I think you also appreciate it a lot more, you know, and you appreciate. But it's, yeah, the little ones, a handful. I treat them like little hecklers, and I managed to keep my daughter's good though. So I was always congratulating myself with how patient I was with my daughter, but she was never really any trouble. And my son is just like, I want to chuck him across a room, really, but I'm not. You're not allowed.
No, they really advocate that you don't. They're very clear on that, actually. But it is funny how like
he hits me. He hits me, and I'm not allowed to hit him back.
Oh, I know, and I'm sure it's a very fair fight. But here's the thing: I think it's like I should not have children so long as I even consider treating them like hecklers, because that's not how you should speak to people.
I guess I wouldn't speak. But I think it was like not wanting to lose your temper with them, because if you lose your temper with the heckler, then it's sort of over. I think you've got to keep your cool, which I always do with my daughter.
Yeah.
And my wife's very impatient, the most impatient person I've ever met, and loses her cool, loses her temper with them straight away. And they love her so much. And I'm like, yeah, God, come on, let them mess around. It's fine. And they, you know, but they see through me and they love her and they, you know,
they treat you with contempt.
They treat me with my daughter definitely with contempt. My son, increasingly, he coppers his big sister. He's very affectionate.
That's very funny.
But, so that's nice.
It's nice.
But yeah, so it's, Now, how's Christmas been? Because you weren't able, obviously, to get back to see your folks.
Yeah, I didn't go home. I'm a massive Christmas person, like huge. Right. I love it. I like everybody else to be on my level of hype. I don't want to hear about how you don't think Christmas is great, like, or you think it's consumerist, like you don't have a novel opinion. We get it. You're a Scrooge. But also, it is my favorite time of the year. I love the food. I love the weather. I love all of it. And I just haven't been able to muster the same enthusiasm because it turns out it is the people and not the presents, which
right.
I'm wow. stunned by. But yeah, don't tell my mom, but yeah, I think it might be the people. So it was a bit of a bummer, but I get why we had to do it, and my mom's high risk, and it wasn't worth traveling back and putting her in.
No, for sure. I think by the time this podcast comes out in 2 weeks, all the people who didn't take your sensible decision are going to probably be, not all of them, but many of them will be ruining their decision. Because it sort of felt like, it was sort of, it's interesting to have a different Christmas. I'm sort of, once you've got kids again, your views of Christmas change a little bit. But for a few years, I've kind of thought, I think Christmas should be every other year. I think it comes along too quickly.
Shut your mouth. Special.
It'd be more special if it was every other year.
Oh my, but, it's not the Edinburgh Fringe, Richard. We can handle one a year, give over. But also, like, I'm sure it's better if you have kids. Has that changed your mind?
Yeah, and, because they got, I mean, now they both get it. So it was very special, and it would be awful to deny them. Because when you're a kid, a year takes a long time. When you're an adult, and especially when you're in your 50s, a year goes like that. It just feels like yesterday that my father-in-law seemed to have COVID over Christmas in hindsight, but maybe he didn't.
Yeah.
he has had it, but and he's had no symptoms apart from last Christmas, but apparently it wasn't here last Christmas, but was it? So I might have had it, but because I got whatever he had. But
I will say,
yeah, so it goes very fast, but no, it's really, yeah, I'm a fan of Christmas. I think we should have just have shifted it to July. If we'd said July, we're going to have a July 25th or June 25th.
I'm doing that anyway. I don't care. It's happening. I will say I shouldn't sound too pious. Like, in many ways, the decision was taken out of my hands because my flight was booked for after Tier 4 was announced. So
right.
I do want to be clear. Like, I probably wouldn't have gone, but I also don't want to be like, yes, I made the right decision. Like, if my mom lived in Brighton, I might have gone, I wish, because that's so not the spirit of the recommendation of the law, right? They weren't like, well, go until 12, it's fine. And after 12, it's not fine. Yeah. But equally, like, I get that this year has been an absolute, like.
Yeah, but they fucked it up. If they'd said in October, look, we're not going to be able to have Christmas, mm-hmm. which they did know, really. And I think they just thought we need people to spend the money, and then we'll
Fuck,
once they've spent the money, we'll reveal that we're not. I think so, because we ended up, we bought,
course,
we were only going to have
course.
Like four other people. We're going to have my wife's family. We're going to come over. So we bought a turkey for eight people, but
of
we
course.
Would, if you'd known in October, you'd have bought a chicken or you'd have bought a very small turkey or half mm-hmm, a turkey. Mm-hmm. So you spent all the money you were going to spend. We spent like loads of money on booze and cheese and turkey. I actually, in the end, I've enjoyed eating. We've eaten the whole turkey.
I was going to say, oh no, too much cheese. What a nightmare.
There's a lot too much cheese. We got a lot of cheese because my brother-in-law loves cheese. And we that's a big family thing. So we did have a lot of cheese. So we're having cheese as our dinner quite
that's
a lot.
That's fine. You can make a mac and cheese,
but we're
cheese
through
pie.
We're through the turkey. Yeah, no, it's nice. So I think if they'd let us all know, then I think people would have accepted it. But I think what's happened is people have done it. I think a lot of people have on the sly met up.
And, 100%.
And what's happening as we're this is the worst day for COVID, I think, of the year. And this isn't even Christmas. This is Christmas parties, maybe, but this isn't even Christmas. So Christmas is going to coincide with this going out. And I'll be delighted to be proven right.
Yes.
As this goes out.
What a win and a victory it will be to discover even more people are ill. And we were right all along. Yes.
You've got to get, but I'm old enough to be, I don't think I'm like huge at risk, but I've had friends my age who've been really ill with it. And, obviously it's possible in your 50s. It's like one of the right-wing columnists was saying, only 177 people under 60 have died in the whole country. And you go, what is 60 the cutoff point? It's all right, as long as you were 61.
Yeah.
That's not a bad knock. Exactly. I don't want to die at 61. It's a bad time to get it now, though, isn't it? If you just the finish line is in view.
Yeah, it does feel like
vaccine could be there.
It does feel like a real, like you've really been unlucky if you get it, or fucking stupid, which I'm gonna guess it's the latter. But you know, I also think it's a shame that they put Christmas on a pedestal. They were very much like, just everyone behave and then we'll all have a big reward at Christmas. So then they kind of shot themselves in the foot, because even if they had wanted to roll it back, they'd made it such a big thing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh God.
Well, even about a week before, Johnson was saying, oh, Keir Starmer wants to cancel Christmas. And that was his, you know, but it's astonishing. It doesn't matter what you say now. I mean, this gets into your satirical work that you do on the mm-hmm. MASH Report, which is fantastic. I was watching some of that again today. It's sort of got to the point where, there's no need to tell the truth at all. There's no repercussions for just barefaced lying about stuff.
Yeah, it does kind of take us to the point, really, which is that we are working from a premise that government acts in our interest or cares for us. We should roll back and remember who is government. Obviously they fucked it, but they don't care or have any remorse for the fact that they've done so. So there's that, at least. Well. They'll plow on.
So you said you'd had a bad day today as well. Is that, have you had a bad day or you just had a weird day today?
How bad is it that in this interview you're like, so someone's had a bad day?
tell me more about the bad things that happened to you.
Okay, well, obviously Christmas was a hoot. And then I thought, what better way to just sort of guide me into the new year than to have a flooded kitchen? And so thankfully my pipes were listening, and they decided to, the one in the kitchen decided to burst yesterday.
Oh, man.
And flood my kitchen. And then I rang the people I was supposed to ring and said, hello, the drainage pipe from my washing machine and dishwasher is obviously burst or loose or something, so it's flooding my kitchen. And they went, it sounds like your washing machine's broken. And I was like, oh no, it's definitely this. And they were like, okay. So they sent a man to fix my washing machine, at which point the washing machine man said, oh no, I think it's the drainage pipe. And I said, it fucking is. Yeah, I did say that. And he said, you need a plumber. And I said, I did try to book one. And then he spoke to the lady on the phone and they agreed that I could do with a different man that I in fact had thought I needed. Okay. But thankfully, while he was here, this man messed with my fuse box enough that for some reason, now that he's left, my heating isn't working.
Oh, no.
So what am I trying to say? It's been, I'm just trying to stay positive, exercise, listen to the Calm app and breathe. And I don't know why my heating isn't working. Look, I don't know if anybody can fix this right now on Twitch, but I don't know why my heating isn't working. I've been down there. Well, everything's on. But listen, I don't want to be like a woman who complains about men. But I would say sometimes today specifically, they really didn't listen to me and it was a real shame. But no, it's fine. I mean, once the kitchen dries up again, I think life's going to go. It's all going to be uphill from there.
I think 2021 is just, we're just waiting for, if you've got two more days and everything will be fine.
I am waiting for my kitchen to 2021 and I'm ready for it. I'm so excited.
I think a lot of people are sort of banking on next year just being good again and not really paying attention to what's going on. I have a feeling, especially in the UK, I think we've...
What do you mean, Richard?
I think we're going to have some stuff to cope with over the next week. Even without COVID.
But it's the new year? It's a new year. I don't know what... Richard, what are you saying to me?
People will be saying, oh, you got a flooded kitchen? Have you got running water in your kitchen? You're allowed to have that. That's wonderful. Oh, well, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry it's all gone so badly wrong for you.
Oh, that's
but, you know,
right.
It's good for the podcast because it's quite funny.
Oh, that's good. I'm so pleased. Yeah. Listen, if people couldn't laugh at my... fucking bin fire of a year, then it would be a real shame. I do thankfully at least have things to say now. There's a bit of news.
I'll give you the chat. I don't usually look at the chat room, but I'll give you their advice.
Please.
Turn it off and on again is the main advice.
Okay.
Somebody said something. It's all disappeared off now.
There
was one good thing there, but it's probably pressure. Have you checked the pressure of the boiler? you know how to do that?
No, I don't know how to do that.
No, you might just fiddle. Find the new house, someone suggests. The thermostat on? Have you put the thermostat on?
It's on, yeah. Thank you. I actually prefer new house. I'm just like, I do sometimes think about just walking out of my apartment and never coming back again.
So the most people are saying check the pressure. So you need to go to your boiler and find the pressure gauge and then dick around with that. But that's the best I can do. Someone will tweet you.
Okay.
One of these nerds will tweet you.
Great. Thanks, guys. Please tweet me. Yeah, this is great. Excellent.
Make sure the pressure is at 1 bar minimum. Rufus T. Firefly the second. These guys are good. You just have a problem. You just come in and then I don't know how to change it.
Is that on the, okay, sorry to be an idiot, but is that on the boiler or on the water tank?
Yeah.
I'm pointing.
On the actual boiler that is. So there should be like a little gauge and with bars, I think, isn't it?
Okay.
The needle. There's a little circle bit with a needle in it. And I don't know how you... someone's saying bleed the radiators.
I've bled the radiators.
Andy McCaig says, I'm not sure we're Corgi certified. someone wants 150 quid.
Oh, my God. You can have...
So you should have an inlet valve that can increase the pressure. I mean, this is useful not just for you, but people at home listening to this podcast are having trouble with their boilers.
Gosh.
So, you know, I don't mind spending 3 or 4 minutes on this because there will be other people... Who similarly?
No, this is
position.
Great. I mean, I have bled the radiators because that's something I learned to do this year. Because I'd never known, because every man in my life has acted like that's a fucking state secret and like there's actual blood involved. Genuinely, my dad would be like, "I'm bleeding the radiators. Don't look." Like I was like he did it with his dick. But he, I was like, "What's going on?" But it turns out, a woman came from British Gas during the year and she was like, "Do you want me to bleed your radiators before I go? I can show you as well if you want." And I was like, what did you just say to me? And she was like, oh, I'm going to show you. And I was like, absolutely dumbfounded. So I like filmed her because I was like, this is going to be complicated. It's just turning a key and letting the air out and waiting for the water. It's like a hand job. Easy.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. Sorry.
I think hand jobs are more complicated.
Probably. I can't say it's been a, it's been a big thing in my life.
Well, I would say the hand jobs I've had from women is more complicated than bleeding a radiator. I'm very good at it myself. But
this is why I sleep with women, my friend. Yeah. Like, yeah, obviously you're better if you have one.
Yeah, well, you should be. I would just say that don't twist it too far and the thing comes out and then the water goes everywhere. This is back to the
radiators.
But I've done that. Good, I've had a thing. Because the hardest thing about bleeding radiators is remembering where your fucking radiator key is. So that's the thing that every time I bleed my radiators, I have to go around the house and work out where I left the key.
I thought initially so little did I know about DIY that I thought it was a key for the window. So I keep mine on the window ledge. So I never forget because I'm like, oh, it's with the other keys for the window. It's fine. But yes, that is a good point. Yeah. You do need to know where it is.
And then I did it once and the bit inside came out and then you've got to screw that back in again. And there's really sometimes quite hot water squirting and dirty water squirting at you.
Oh,
so just,
no.
Just play it. Just be very gentle. Or twist it gently.
Are we still on radiators?
I went back to the hand job. Just turn it gently and it'll be fine.
Okay.
Good. Well, oh dear.
Rules for life. This is good.
So let's see what else should I talk to you about? But let's try and cheer you up. Well, look, I'm interested in this because you obviously raised in Ireland and your dad. It says on Wikipedia, by the way, citation needed on this. So we can use this podcast as citation, to get the citation. Your dad is and was a Catholic deacon.
He is.
Yes. So there we go. That's what needed a citation.
Yeah,
on the Wikipedia
he is.
Page.
My dad entered the diaconate when I was, I guess he started training for it when I was 19 and was ordained when I was like 23 because you have to do a degree theology. And that's what he is. It's like a it's like a part-time priest, I guess. They're not paid, they're like lay priests, essentially.
Okay. So he was when you were growing up, he's become one since you've become an adult.
Yes. So my dad was training to be a priest in a seminary when my mom met him.
Oh right, okay.
And then he met my mother, and then he was written out of wills and she was referred to as the devil woman. What a saga. And then because he realized he wanted to have kids. What? Gross. Yeah. And then, so he always had the proclivity. And then, because the Irish Catholic Church are a bit like the mafia, they kind of kept tabs on him. And so when they brought in the diaconate, they were like, do you remember when you used to want it? Do you still want it? And he was like, okay. But I guess basically what happened in Ireland was they were running out of priests. And they couldn't have women do it, obviously. So they just let married men do it. But it's really weird because if you're not married when you're a deacon, you have to take the vow of celibacy. But if you are married, you have that wife. But if she dies, then you don't get to have any more sex.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
It's an odd thing to, out of all the, I mean, there's many odd things about religion, but where does that come from? And because that's only, is that only Catholicism of the Christian churches that forbids that? I bet it isn't, but it's sort of odd to you know, to,
I think Buddhist
a very
monks,
natural thing, and you know, and it's going to lead to problems, isn't it? Because you're going to get people, the kind of people who gravitate towards that,
I think,
are maybe going to be into, have other interests.
Yeah, it's disconcerting. I don't know where the correlation is, but it's very disconcerting, and it's such an odd one, given that like priests in Ireland function as like family counselors so often.
Yeah,
and it's like, well, what the hell is he going to tell you about having a wife? He doesn't freaking know, like, or anything else. But I think Buddhists do it as well. Monks, right? Sometimes are celibate.
Yeah.
But there's really no need. Like, I think if anything, it would make the whole thing seem a lot more normal if they could just have sex.
I hate to go back to the chat room. Dr. Von Too, the church was 1,000 years old before it definitively took a stand in favor of celibacy in the 12th century at the Second Lateran Council held in 1139, I think this might be copy and pasted, when a rule was approved forbidding priests to marry. In 1563, the Council of Trent reaffirmed the tradition of celibacy. So for the first 1,000 years, priests were allowed to have wives. And, you know, if you've seen the Borgias and things.
Oh, yeah, those popes had kids, for sure.
They were all at it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Mm. It seems, you know, I'm not going to start having a go just at the Catholics. All religions are a bit weird, but it seems an odd decision. But I was going to see, the reason I was interested in it was because my dad's a headmaster. A lot of comedians have, you know, priests or various clergymen as fathers, bishops. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's a couple of bishops' kids are comedians. Do you think there's something in that? Do you think there's something in a father being a figure of authority that, I mean, obviously your dad wasn't really when you were growing up, so fall apart as an argument.
I mean, he was a deacon for, I guess, he started the process well before, because I didn't start comedy till I was 27, but, right. And he was very religious and we went to mass a lot. So I guess that was a big, I think to a degree you could definitely say that, like, being used to watching somebody captivate or fail to captivate an audience on a weekly basis is a pretty intrinsic part of religion.
Yeah.
I would say that if you are within it in that very close way, which I was raised, and you go against it, then you have to learn to defend that position and speak up for yourself and take on a large group of people, probably quite often, and deflect with humor or justify with whatever it is. So maybe that is part of.
I mean, my parents were and are quite religious. Not, I was made to go to church and stuff when I was younger. We were C of E, and I quickly turned against it. I was sort of into it and then turned against it at about the age of 8, I would say.
Oh, okay. I would say I was into it till I was like 17. But I also think like there's a real hardened cynicism that comes with having thought you had faith and then losing faith. Like I think there is something in that like it really, it's a bit like a heartbreak, but it also makes you the fool. So I think maybe that lends itself to comedy. Okay.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of nonsense in religion. I think if you do, whatever way you look at it, it's very, if you really study it, it contradicts, you know, the Bible contradicts itself over and over again. But there's sort of crazy stuff in there. So I think, like, if you've got the kind of mind that's a comedic mind, I think you'll, even if you keep your faith, which some people do, I think you can still see the intrinsic kind of humor in.
Absolutely. Also, in an Irish Catholic community as small as the one I was raised in, religion was a tool for policing other people's behavior. So it was effectively a study of people, which is glorious, and reporting on other people to each other, which is like incredible. Like, so, and in the way that I was raised, it was sort of a lower middle class community. So how pious you were would sort of contribute to your sort of middle class appearance. So it was like it compensated for a lack of money, which meant that it was competitive, which is also brilliant. But it was definitely a study of people. And like, also absolutely insane stuff happens in churches. Like, insane. Like, one of my cousins was christened, and the father was absent, shall we say. And whatever month of gospel it was that year, or that, and that month, just while she was being christened, over the altar, there was just a banner that said, "Where is the father?" And truly, it was just a whole bunch of people trying to keep their shit together and not laugh all the way through this poor child's christening. And it's like, or like, I went home and my mom was like, "Did you hear about the pigeon?" And I was like, "No." And what kind of sentence is that? And she's like, "You heard about the pigeon in the church." I was like, "I didn't hear about the pigeon in the church, because that kind of travel news does not travel the Irish Sea. What are you talking about?" And she's like, "Well, there was only a pigeon in a church." And she, they didn't know what to do with the church. So then they prayed to, I think it's Saint, maybe it's Assisi, who's like of animals, to get this bloody thing to come out. But it was causing a fuss during Mass, and everyone was up in arms about the pigeon in the church because it was disrespectful. Anyway, it was going to shit in the altar. They were sure it was going to shit in the altar, and they couldn't have it. So I was like, "Mom, what is the point of the story? And what do they do to the pit? Because they not just open the door." And she's like, "Your father was down there opening the doors. They tried that for ages, Catherine. They put the bread outside." She said, "That only brought more pigeons. There was a load of pigeons outside the church. Then they wanted more." No, they didn't want more pigeons in the church. Anyway, they just shot it. And I was like, "What?" And she was like, "Oh yeah, they just shot it." And I was like, "Sorry, so you prayed to the patron saint of animals and then you killed an animal?" And she was like, "It wasn't me, Catherine. I don't know why you're coming at me with this." And I was like, "You told me this story." And like, I don't know, there's just the physicalization of contradiction that is so personally exemplified in churches is funny. And I maybe you couldn't help but pick up on that. I also think maybe, like, maybe there's something in like the need for other people to believe what you do, which I think is sometimes what comedy is an endeavor in achieving.
Yeah, maybe. But also, you know, it sort of strikes me as a bit like social media. It's sort of social media before social media, isn't it? In that you're trying, you group together with people who agree with you and get cross with people who don't agree with you. And you're all trying to show off and point up other people's hypocrisy and hope no one turns that on you.
Absolutely. Like
whenever on social media someone's go, "How dare," I think like Frankie Boyle was getting it this week because he was critical of Ricky Gervais. And then people go, "How can Frankie Boyle say that when he's done jokes about this in the past?" You know, how can anybody say anything about anything?
Yep.
You've all fucked up for something in the past. You've all changed your mind about something. You've all said something ridiculous. How can anyone even like start throwing the hypocrisy angle at someone? It's fine. You know, if you've changed your mind about something, that doesn't make you a hypocrite. It means you've learned and grown.
Oh, no, but you couldn't have learned. You were either wrong or you were right, and that's the end of it. Honestly, it's all there in the Bible, Richard. It's very clear. It absolutely is that. I think it's a good description. But I don't know. I wonder also if maybe, like, I mean, I'm really trying to answer your question, but I am completely hypothesizing. But I feel like maybe there's something in, like, rules. And I think there's something very like sensible about people who are raised in the church, and they want sensible goals and they want sensible, safe outcomes, and they want to be able to ensure those with rules. And I know like being a comedian does not make any sense to my family, or it certainly didn't. And I'm not even sure it makes sense to me because it seems so outside of the bounds of safe. But maybe that's why it's appealing to us. I don't know.
A comedian wants to question things that, you know, not necessarily even come up with answers, but, you know, that's the beauty of being a comedian, is you don't have to have the solution to anything.
Nope.
You just have to point out where things are bad. But if you start questioning religion, it starts falling apart. And if you're a religious person and you're really into it, you can't really start questioning it. You have to believe it all and then build on it. It's the same thing that's happening in politics.
Yeah.
In that now you have to have this sort of cult-like belief in your leader, and if you anyone who questions anything about that leader or suggests they're lying or they're not perfect,
it's a fucking traitor.
It's a heretic and a traitor. So we're shifting our religion. It's obviously something innately human that we need to. It's something about society and being social, bringing together. But there we.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Go. But so was that, did you know as a teenager, I mean, presumably you did, that you were interested in girls as well as boys, or girls instead of boys? And was that a difficult thing to then deal with coming from a religious family,
So I went to an all-girls school. What? I know. And inevitable. And I thought I was gay insofar as I thought about it at all. I will say I was not a very sexual teenager. Like, I didn't kiss anyone until I was 19. I was very studious and very arrogant with my academics, and very sure that what was most important about me was that I was smarter than you, in the way that only 16-year-olds can feel. And because I was completely unaware of all that I didn't know. But I would say, so I wasn't super sexual, but insofar as I was, I thought I was gay. But I also knew that that was not something I could ever say in school, because otherwise I wouldn't have anywhere to eat lunch or get changed or you know, socialize. So I was like, I knew that was off the table. It was only when I got to university and met boys that I was like, oh, this also, yes, please. So then I figured out I was bi. But it's strange because people don't quite always assume this or believe this, but I was also raised in an incredibly liberal home in terms of at least talking. We talked about gay people. Gay people were like, that was a thing that was accepted. And I didn't know any, and we didn't speak of it that much, but it was like everyone, like my parents are very socialist in their Catholicism. And they think one feeds the other. But I would say that when it came in practice to the reality of coming out in a Catholic home, then it became more of a difficulty. But I would say that after an awful lot of hard work and self-reflection, my parents got there. And I think most religious parents do get there, because yeah. I do actually think that most religious people, apart from like, obviously as a group, they can be read very differently, but I think one-to-one, especially with most people, A, love their kids. B, like, if you're religious, you probably want to do good. You probably have empathy. You probably want everyone around you to live the best lives they can. It's just that you differ on how that's done. But yeah, no, it was definitely difficult. And I was definitely aware all the way through my teenage years that it was sinful and bad and perceived as disgusting and perceived as extremely fringe. So yes, it did.
But does that make it hotter as an adult that you're breaking all the rules of your childhood?
No, I think it might still be bound up too much in trauma, but I get why, from your perspective, it would be. No, yeah, I can see how that would be. But no, it definitely was just I think it definitely makes it cooler. Like, yeah. I definitely look back and go, like, by 18, I was sure and I was going to say it and I was going to back myself up and I was happy to have the argument. And I debated at university and in school and had like debated about queer rights and gay rights in a very theoretical sense without openly acknowledging those things. So I'd had time to practice and I was like good to go. And I think that's quite cool because I don't think it ever occurred to me, but I could have just kept it a secret for a while. Like, I could have done that, which I kind of wish I had thought of, but I didn't. I was too brazen.
I think I'm sort of interested in the sort of genesis as you were a comedian, but you wanted to be an actor, right, originally. So you went to drama school, presumably after university, and to Central, which is a very good drama school. So you were sort of obviously pushing in that direction. And at what point did you're obviously doing public speaking and things like that. But at what? And you seem very naturally funny to me.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's all right. And in all the stuff I've listened to, you know, in conversation and including this one, that I've been listening to today, was comedy just something that kind of occurred to you a few years ago, or was it in your blood before that? Do you think?
I don't think it was in my blood at all. I don't think anyone would have described me as the funny girl in any way, shape, or form. I was like a really keen nerd and. Then a very competitive debater and took myself very seriously. But I think a couple of things that happened that changed that. I was after university. I mean, I've talked about this a lot of times, but I was hospitalized and got this like, had this hugely shame laden experience of having like come out as the queer one and then being like what I perceived as the broken one and then didn't do any of the things in the order that I was meant to. Cause instead of going to wherever I should have been going on to get a job, I went to hospital and then went to drama school and those two were not different enough. But the point is that I wanted to be an actor, but my parents wanted me to have a, you know, mortgage, which is now I realize they were right. So I did theater at night during my degree, my undergrad, and then did an MA in Central. And I think Central also partly broke me in a way that I needed to be broken for comedy because it was awful. I hated it. It was bad. Yeah. Especially in a 1 year course in drama school, I think how most of the like prestigious ones work is that they break you down and then they build you back up. But in a year, they only have time to break you down and then they just fuck you out on the street and you're like, oh, okay. But I somehow ended up on a course of people. All of the men were from Yorkshire and all of the women were on juice cleanses. And I don't know how that division worked, but I was not either. And there was one other redhead and she was Australian and we just sort of held each other close for the year and tried to get 3 meals a day. And it was a lot and I hated it, but it made me it made me disillusioned with acting. And and then I didn't really get any work because I had no fucking clue about the industry. And then I was bored and fell into comedy I was running a women's night in property in the job I was temping at. And they were like, last year we had cocktails and manicures. And I was like, that seems binary and prescriptive. And they were like, cool, then you pick something. And I was like, oh, fuck. So then I organized a comedy night. And then the people who ran that were like, you seem gobby. Do you want to give it a go? Are you like this when you're sober kind of thing? And that is how I got into comedy. And then I did it and I was just addicted, like instantly. I don't know if you had that, but it was like...
Well, I just always wanted to do it. I was always into comedy and writing and coming up with stuff. And I, you know, and for a while I wanted to be an actor when I was young, but it was always comedy that I was interested in. And I don't think I thought, you know, I grew up in Somerset, which is, you know, the same as being in Ireland.
Yeah.
It didn't seem like a possibility that, you know, I would watch things on TV and go, wouldn't it be amazing to being the young ones or something like that, you know. So it's the idea of it actually being a reality seemed so impossible that I, you know, it was what I wanted to do, but I didn't think it was possible. So it was only when I went to university and started doing okay within university circles. We did comedy at school, you know, we did write our own stuff at school.
Really?
So it was, yeah, it was stuff I was interested in, you know, something I was interested in. So I was writing sketches and just learning comedy. I wasn't really interested in music. I was interested in, you know, words and comedy.
That's so cool, though. We didn't have anything like that in, I didn't have it in school. I didn't have it in university. I mean, I think it was probably there in university. It just, I'd never been told I was funny ever. So
yeah,
I think that's the other thing is like, you can be like a class clown or like a guy who's really funny on stag do's and be hopeless at, as a stand up. And you can be like kind of a, like pedantic introvert and be an amazing stand-up. So
yeah,
not that I'm either.
No, I think it's true. Well, I think, you know, what's interesting is the more, you know, I obviously have talked to a lot of comedians on this, and I am interested in the genesis and in, and as Robin Ince's, I was talking about Robin Ince's book a lot last year, but just what makes people become a comedian. And I don't think there is anything, but the things that, you know, the things, but like having a different lifestyle, having mental illness, having an authority figure parent, which are all things that that you kind of tick those boxes somewhere along the line. So I think, but no, you know, but I think I, you know, I had quite a straight upbringing in sort of every sense, really. And I don't think I wasn't rebellious, really. I was a bit naughty because I was trying to be funny, but that was it. But I was, you know, my dad was my headmaster, which is the closest I can get to it. But in the show I did about that, I kind of concluded I was interested in comedy way before that, so I don't think that's
even about
made...
you, Dad. Fuck you. Yes,
it wasn't. You know, I was just I've always loved people who make me laugh, and I've always loved comedy, which I guess is why I'm doing this. You know, why I'm okay at this, because I still, unlike some middle aged comedians, I still like.
Yes.
Yeah, they still like comedy, and I still like new comedy, and you know, I'm kind of interested in the form. So it's you know, it's. But yes, I don't know. I don't think I've really got any massive, you know, event in my life. Like losing a parent or something like that is a lot of comedians have lost a parent or lost someone very significant in their childhood. But I think, you know, it is a way of coming to terms with something, isn't it?
Yeah, I think death definitely plays into it. Yeah. I do think that like, of listening to you talk about it, I guess it kind of occurs to me that, like, for me, comedy has at least, I don't know if it's the genesis or the consequence, but it's been sort of a subversion of shame. Like, right. All the things that should have, that were bad and that I associated with my weakness or my failures or my wrongness are somewhat celebrated in comedy, or at least, like, they're either celebrated in comedy because they make me distinct, or they give me a point of view, or they are, I now have a new place to go. So where in my brain they used to go to like a spiral of shame and doom, now just at least a tiny part of my brain goes, is it funny? Will it be fun? Like my world blew up this year to a degree, and still 2 weeks later, my brain was still like, I mean, is it kind of funny? Like, is it a little bit funny?
Oh, there'll be an award-winning show for probably both of you.
I don't think that. You can't share an award, Richard. You can't.
You're the new Sarah Pascoe and John Robbins. You're both gonna get nominated.
I don't know about
and
that,
then,
but
then
I
have it all again.
But I do know that, like, yeah, it's. I think that's a healthy thing, and I think other people probably have it with like art or, you know, whatever people's passions are, but I didn't have it until I figured out that I liked stand-up.
Sure. Well, I think it's, you know, and there are lots of places, including your stand-up shows, where people can hear you talk about all of these things very wittily and very, but you know, I think you are very eloquent about the stuff, so it's very interesting to hear you talk about OCD, but I think useful again for anyone going through those things. But, you know, but also, well, I think you're the roast battle that you did with your ex-girlfriend was one of the absolute highlights, I think, of that series as well. It was a really, really funny roast battle. Thank you. But also, but as the point was made by, I think, one of you at the time, and maybe it was your girlfriend, but, you know, the idea of two out, you know, women who were going out with each other talking on TV about those exact things for even for you, and you're much younger than me, would not have happened in your childhood. So true. You know, that's really important and really great, and it's worth looking at because it's. I don't even want to ruin it.
Thank you. I agree. I think it was, really, it is something I'm really proud of and that we did together and that was cool. And we'll have that. And that's the thing is, I think like two things on that. One, when we were going on, they were like, you're our first ever lesbian couple, as in even in the American version. And we were like, wow. How the fuck is that true? And why is that still true? But cool. But how is that still true? But cool. But also like that it reminds me of a nice thought, which is that like I don't think relationships that are over are necessarily relationships that are failed, and ours was meant to end when it did, but we did some really fucking cool things, and we definitely learned to do stand-up. I learned to do stand-up in that relationship, and having somebody who understood comedy and who cared about every fucking trip to Northampton or Southampton or wherever the hell I didn't know I was going when I agreed to do the gig for £50 it was a perfect storm for making us good comics, I think.
Sure. But I think also being able to, you know, being able to discuss those subjects openly and honestly, and, you know, and it's sort of things have moved on enough, I think, that it's, you know, it's more than being, you know, it's not like you're the first people who have done it, but that's better because then you can, you're moving on to, it's more about you as human beings rather than, hey, look, here's the first person who's ever been this doing comedy, which is often, you know, it's a very, very, it's very difficult to be the first even female stand-up, really, you know, it was, you know, in the 70s and 80s, Marty Kane or Victoria Wood were like, what? You know, there's a funny woman. It was such a rarity.
Oh, we're so lucky. Like, yeah. And I think that all the time when I'm in places like the store, to be like so grateful to people like Joe Brand who fucking took the brunt of that shit. And it doesn't mean that it's okay now, but it does mean there's a breath of us and there's a couple of us at the same time in the same place. And yeah, we actually get to talk about what we want to talk about and not excuse or explain our presence, which is really lucky.
Sure. But it's great. So it's true. I mean, we won't. The only thing I was interested in about just about you. I've heard you talk about it on another podcast briefly. But like when you were in therapy and all the things that get tried, you know, with therapy, therapy is a very interesting subject because you look back 50 years at what they were doing in therapy and you go, that's mental. Why were they doing that to people? And I wondered out of the things that they went through for you in this kind of quite intensive 4 months of therapy, which of the things do you think in 50 years time or now people would look back and go, that was nuts.
So when
why were they doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. When I was in hospital, they were doing a practice that was at the time questionable, right? So like, I read a lot about my illness. What? The obsessive was obsessive. Yes. And it was very much like up, like a contentious form of treatment at the time. And I don't know if they still do it, but it's called flooding. And it's where people with OCD are exposed to their exact fear. So the theory being, if you make them do it, they will understand that it doesn't cause the effect. The brain will learn that it doesn't cause the effect that they think they will do, which is like ultimately where you're trying to get to with OCD, but not necessarily where you take somebody who, for example, has washed their hands to such a state that they can't open them because they're so hard, or somebody who hasn't gone outside their front door because they're so terrified of other people. I wouldn't say those people should be like made touch a toilet seat or put on public transport and left alone whilst watched from afar. I would say that's pretty fucking toxic. And so flooding was a big one, and I had real difficulty touching other people, especially men. And I remember one of the first days, and like even just to admit that to a group of people, strangers, is so fucking terrifying. And like to admit what you think will happen if you do is so embarrassing and shame laden. And then they're like, okay, thank you for sharing. All right, everyone up. Catherine will be around to touch all of you. What the fuck? Like it was so problematic. And just this old man leading this group, of course. And I think, forget in the future, I hate that now.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a work experience person's gonna go, have you thought about just the people who are scared of stuff, just make them do the thing?
It's like...
That, they, They're scared. Why are they scared of it? It's all right. They give it. Let make them do it.
It's absolutely what some fucking Channel 4 producer would pitch as a show. Like,
yeah.
Okay, so you have a mental illness. How do we get you to do the mental illness, but like for other people's amusement? Okay, great. Let's have that. Fucking horrible. Yeah.
Oh dear. Well, but overall, it was a positive experience, though, right? In terms of it helped a deal to go through those 4 months.
Oh my god, it saved my life.
Yeah.
It's still saving my life. Yeah, 100%. It saved my life. Yeah. Sure.
Cool. Right. Well,
not that guy. But the rest of them, guy. Yeah.
There's lots and lots of great interviews you've done about this, and I would advise people if they're interested in that to go and listen to those, because we don't have time to talk about it in the depth that it needs to be talked about. We've already done an hour and it's gone by very quickly. I said to this to you, and like, there's loads of stuff I want to talk to you about. Let's talk with this year, having been forced to come online myself more than I mean, obviously I was online a lot anyway, but to do these podcasts remotely rather than with an audience, I really want to get back to having an audience, because it's sort of what made this podcast a bit different than the others as well. And it's a different experience. I think for the comedians, it's a different experience. Having said that, I've really enjoyed doing these online, we will be carrying on doing them online for the foreseeable future, I think. I wanted to try and get as many people on this year as who are doing interesting things with the internet and have kind of coped with the loss of all their gigs by starting new stuff up, which you've done. So you've started an online gig.
Yeah. I have.
So tell us about that.
I would say being a cam clown was not the dream. That is true. But here we find ourselves. And yeah, I run a weekly gig called Gigless, and it's on every Thursday. And I was really skeptical of them, but it's actually turned out to be really magic. And it's this thing that I have to have something new for every week, and where I have other comics on. And they're always brilliant, because actually, right now, everyone's really grateful for a gig. So I have had the most amazing lineups. You're doing it. I'm so excited. But I feel like I've gotten you and other people where I'm like, I can't fucking believe they've agreed to do this gig. I mean, please don't bail. But I'm like, I can't believe you're agreeing to do this gig. And it's been amazing. And what's nice about it is that I've had lots of really new, brilliant new acts on. And they're getting their groceries paid for the week, because another big name has agreed to do it. And that means people come to the show. And it's been a really nice way to land, like, spread, because I split all the ticket sales evenly. So that's been a really nice, like, thing I felt like I could do. But mainly, like, 200 people come every week. And the thing about it is, that's cool, I think, that we forget about the internet is, like, it's not the same as being in an intimate space, but also people watch it from all over the world, and they watch it, like, people who couldn't necessarily go to, not just because they don't live in London, but maybe accessibility wise or cost wise wouldn't be able to go to stand up as much,
or just because they got kids, like, you know, that's, you know, you've got a family at home, you can't go out, but you can absolutely sit downstairs while your kids are asleep and watch a show online. I mean, I've said this a lot this year, but it's I really hope comedy clubs, and some of them definitely are, but there's a big lesson to learn for the live gigs, because you can film all gigs can be filmed, and there's a whole new revenue stream for everyone, you know, that they can then share against, make some money for themselves and share amongst the act.
Absolutely. And also, like, people can also, like, be more interactive, as in, like, some of the times I book lineups because people are like, oh, hey, in the chat are like, hey, what do we think about this person? And then you know, it helps. It's more, you actually feel more communication between you and the audience. And so it's not the kind of intimate you get in a comedy club, but I do think it's a different kind of community and intimacy. I mean, God, I'm really up on I really love online gigs now. It turns out I was so skeptical, but now I sound like a fervent enthusiast, which I am.
But again, I think, again, it's something that comedians have to realize. And I think, like, is again, it'll be, I'm very lucky in that I just got into online stupidly long ago. Yeah. And so was absolutely geared up for this year, and, you know, knew what, and understood the possibilities of it. But so many comedians have their eggs in one basket, and then, and I know you can't, it's very difficult to just start something up. So I think comedians have to realize they have to be juggling a few different, you can't just stop doing those once you're back in the clubs. But there's lots of appealing, you know, it's appealing. The idea of just being able to do a 20-minute set from my attic and then go back downstairs and have a drink with my wife is, you know, rather than driving to South London or something.
Oh my God, it's so good. It's so good. You can be finished and in the bath in 10 minutes. Although I will say there's a unique coldness in the shame of dying online and then closing your laptop to the silence of your own home. It's like, at least if you're in Northampton, you feel like you can leave it there, get on the bus and drive away from it. Like you're somehow distancing from the death. But there is something about just closing the... Okay, thank you. That was
everything I'm doing has no like live or, you know, there's people in chat rooms where I don't often look at it in nearly everything I'm doing.
Okay.
And so I don't know, like all the, I know, I don't know. I've done 25 episodes of my ventriloquist show. I have no idea if it's funny. I think it's funny, but I have no idea. I have nothing apart from that clap. I've done the Clapham Grand. I've done that Hartford Theatre with the dummy and kind of wimped out of doing what I do with it anyway. And I've no idea if it's funny. I mean, I suspect it is funny.
But
people are tuning in.
That's bad, though. Do you just go off like what your instinct is based on how it went that evening? You don't want to hear people.
I just decide whether I think it's funny or not. I mean, you know, people get in touch with you and let you know a bit. So I know that people are enjoying it. But also, it took a little getting over, but I did a few things with a couple of people we've had on. Stevie Martin and Bilal Zafar had me on their very improvised shows. And you kind of think, well, actually, there's something very freeing about going into a whole evening with basically nothing, which is what I'm doing mainly with that show now, is just basically going, right, let's see what comes. I'll think about what's in the news and then I'll see what the puppets say. And then we'll go from there.
I'll see what the puppet says to me. That's
see what the puppet says.
Amazing.
And so, you know, so that's very liberating and very interesting. And there's absolutely no way I would have got it. I think in the back of my mind, I've been thinking, I'd quite like to do something that those ventriloquist dummies of my great granddad's ventriloquist dummies. But, you know, I can't ever see, you know, maybe a late night Edinburgh show where you mess around in an attic somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually be able to do it actually in an attic every week and then you just, you know, and work out where you go with it as you're doing it. It's really interesting. So I think there's so much creative possibilities within.
I do genuinely agree.
What's available to us.
I agree. I think it's a really special time. And actually, the gig that I run has provided this really weird space for me because on stage, I'm relatively high status. If you fuck with me, I will end you. And or in my head, that's how I feel. As it turns out, I think that presents actually as like, I can say whatever I want because I actually look like a little doll and everyone's like, she's so nice. She couldn't possibly mean it. And I'm like, I fucking hate you. But that works in clubs, but it doesn't work in my gig because some of these people have come 25 weeks in a row. They think I'm their friend and they like me and they're invested in me, but I can't just turn around and be a cutting little bitch if they say something, if they ask a question. So now if they ask a question, I actually have to answer it and engage with people and bring people in. And that shouldn't be a new challenge, but it is a new challenge. And it's exciting because then it actually means I'm more open and will respond to questions that I haven't thought to ask or that they'll just ask me about anything because there isn't a stage and lighting and enough of a blockade. And that's, I guess it's the same thing where you go in a little bit more defenses down and you're more responsive and it does bring up stuff that you wouldn't have otherwise, which is cool.
So see, 2020 has been a good year.
It's not
year,
all
Catherine.
Bad.
It's been a good year. Look, we take
George
I broke,
is a fucking
this
stretch,
is like
Richard
drama
Herring.
School. I broke you down at the beginning in order to build you up. And look where we've got to. This has all been me. I've orchestrated this whole thing.
God.
And now you can go out into 2021 where everything's going to be fine.
I'm glad you finally agree. Oh, God.
Well, look, there was going to be loads of what I was going to talk to you about, but this has been absolutely great. I think you're terrific. I don't know. I haven't seen much of you like live, but I've seen you online and on the Match Report, which I love. I think you're great. Maybe there's a great thing with puppets that I like.
Irish
I'm not
border.
Obsessed with puppets. the Irish border, explain the Irish border with the Sesame Street characters and the thing you did with the. With Felicity and here about
immigrants that people find
fitting
acceptable.
In as an immigrant is absolutely brilliant. So do check that out. I think that's even on your website.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
That's good. But thanks so much for doing this and being my last live guest of 2020.
Thanks for having me.
It's been terrific. Talking of ventriloquism, my guest next week is the UK's second best ventriloquist, Nina Conti. So I'll give her some advice
What's her name?
Next week, it's going to be Nina Conti.
Oh, right. She does puppet stuff, does she?
Yeah, she does some puppet
stuff.
Okay. And she's all right.
Yeah.
She's not. She's no Richard Herring. Let's just put it that way. Let's put it that way. Thank you very much. Do check out Giggless. It's absolutely terrific. And what I liked about it, one of the first times I retweeted it, was it just you had like one token man and it was all female comics on it. And that's, again, that's something you can do when you're in control.
It is the preferred booking policy of Giggless, yes.
It's really good. It's really great to see it. And they were all like top-rate, fantastic comics as well. Anyway, I'll let you go. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Catherine Bohart, thank you very much. See you next time
thank
in
you.
2021. It's going to be great in 2021. Hooray! You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Catherine Bohart. The music's by Pest. You know all the deals by now, my fan friends. I'm indebted to my producer and director and friend, Chris Evans, not that one. I would also like to thank Ben Walker for all the work he does on helping us with the advertising stuff at the moment, and hopefully we'll be back in full production mode at some point in 2021. Thank you to Acast, British Comedy Guide, Ian Tunes, all that. All those guys. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Why not head to GoFasterStripe.com? You can buy downloads, DVDs and books of mine and loads of other brilliant comedians. GoFasterStripe.com/badges if you want to help us make more content. And I think at the moment, if you buy any of my physical products, you will get 5 Punani sticker album stickers as well if you're trying to complete the collection. Do keep your eye on Twitter, where I will retweet swaps. All right, my fine friends, see you next time on
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.